طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. In late October, the Israeli government declared six Palestinian human rights groups to be terrorist organizations, a designation that criminalizes their work under Israeli law and enables Israel to seize assets, arrest staff, prohibit funding, and punish public expressions of support and solidarity. With this terror designation, the Israeli government has escalated its long-time efforts to crush Palestinian organizations that document Israel's ongoing violations of Palestinian human rights and seek to hold Israel accountable. Leading human and civil rights experts Jamal Dakwar from the ACLU, Rabia Ekbaraya from Adala, and Dimi Khalidi from Palestine Legal discuss the work of the targeted Palestinian NGOs, the context and the impact of this terror designation, reactions from governments and NGOs in the U.S. and the EU, and expectations of impact. The discussion begins with the first question asked by moderator Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, who sponsored this forum.
So diving right in, and we have a lot to cover. Rabia, I want to start with you. Speaking in your capacity as an authority on Israel's legal system, can you first talk a bit about how these designations that took place a week ago today, how are they possible under Israel's 2016 anti-terror law? And what do these designations mean under Israeli law for the six NGOs in concrete terms?
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, everybody, for having this important event. I will delve right directly into your question, Laura, and say that, well, if we want to understand these designations, obviously there is two important contexts. As a matter of law, the 2016 anti-terror law that Israeli Knesset enacted is the legal framework that is at play here. And this legal framework is problematic in itself. It was enacted in 2016 as an aim to replace legislation or legal corpus that was still in force from the British colonial period, from the British mandate, which is actually part of it are still used both in Israel proper and in the West Bank, even after the enactment of this anti-terror law. But what happened with the enactment of this law is that it gave extensive powers to the executive branch, particularly, and to the prosecution and to the courts to smear many legitimate claims under the pretext of anti-terrorism. So the law broadened the authority of Israel to consider certain acts or certain expressions as terror related. So this is the general framework. We still have cases just coming up in the last couple of years that are using this law, and we are still challenging the use of this authority, in particular against political leaders, Palestinian citizens who are political leaders who are charged according to this legislation with charges of incitement in particular, which is an overbroad interpretation of what is previously could have, even according to the Supreme Court of Israel, been a legitimate speech. So this is the general framework. It is obviously a dangerous framework. It is obviously an unprecedented framework that is cracking down on dissent, on political views, and on Palestinians in particular. Now, within this context, the designation of the six Palestinian organizations came in accordance with this law and the provisions it provides to consider these civil society organizations as quote-unquote terror organizations. The law works territorially, right? So it is legislated by the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. So ostensibly, it does not apply directly to the West Bank, where these organizations are founded and operate their offices. But, and there's a huge but, although the law applies territorially, it has extraterritorial consequences, and it has it still pertains and has legal force to extraterritorial entities such as the six organizations we're talking about, but also beyond that. And what I mean, so just to make it clear, the military, who is the authority, the legal authority in the West Bank, has not issued an order that designates these organizations as terrorist organizations. So supposedly this order or this designation applies only to Israeli law within the Green Line, within Israel proper, but this can have huge ramifications for considering these organizations as terror organizations according to Israeli law. And I will give examples. So first of all, we know that there is a mishmash between the legal situation in Israel and according to Israeli law and to the law pertaining to the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, right? So there is different legal framework that should apply, but there is a huge overlap, and the actors are still the same actors that can employ their discretion based on the same consideration. And this has happened before. Now, the designation of the six organizations as terror organizations according to Israeli law can have consequences of on movement of members of these organizations, namely, if anybody wants to cross the borders or go to Jordan, for example, or enter for some reason Jerusalem, this can supposedly the law becomes territorially, the jurisdiction of the law applies. But beyond that, this can become a pretext to arrest and detain people who are involved in these organizations under the pretext of like administrative detention. Beyond that, it still has immediate effect on citizens of Israel itself, including obviously Palestinian citizens who might be held or charged in pursuance of the glorification or incitement provisions, which basically can be sometimes a Facebook post or an online post. And we have had cases as such in Adala with, for example, Raja Ighbari, who's a political leader of the Abna' al-Balad movement, and Kamal Khatib as well, who are all prominent political leaders of the Palestinian citizens in Israel. So we can see that this also may have consequences that are directly about speech, about movement, about administrative detention. But beyond that, obviously, the main point of this designation is to stop the funds, right? So, and this is articulated first when I saw this designation. I saw the Diallo Shammas tweet about this, and I thought this was brilliant articulation. The idea of using anti-terror legislation is to stop after years and years, and we can talk more about that later, but after years of trying to target civil society and these particular organizations, we are seeing that Israel is resorting to its national legislation and using this 2016 extensive measures to basically try to cut foreign funds for these organizations because banks simply won't take the risk anymore.
Thanks. And we're going to delve into a lot of things you mentioned. For folks who didn't see news this morning, that last piece that Obia is talking about, we've already seen this now starting. There's a Finnish NGO which announced they were cutting off funding to one of the groups. In the statement they made clear that they have found no evidence that any money is being misused or going to terror, and they like the organization, but that because of the banking implications, they are forced to cease the funding, or it will end up hurting them in their work worldwide, which is, I would argue, exactly what the playbook is here. I want to take this in a slightly different direction. Jamil, can you, let's go back. You tweeted a while ago about the fact that the government, Israeli government escalation against both the Palestinian and Israeli human rights groups really started with the Goldstone Report in 2009. Can you talk a little bit about that? I'm not sure if everyone here is old enough to remember the Goldstone Report. I remember it like it was yesterday. Can you give us a little background on that? And can you give us background on the punitive and restrictive measures that the Israeli government has taken against civil society in the wake of that report and in the wake of their outrage at the role of human rights groups in that report? And you know, to what extent, if you're comfortable, can you talk about how you see the timing of this effort to label the six NGOs as terrorist groups? You know, looking at the Goldstone Report as a precedent, I mean, it has been suggested that the timing is not unlinked to the war crimes investigation before the ICC. If you feel comfortable weighing in on that too.
Absolutely. First, thank you very much for organizing this webinar. I'm very pleased and honored to be with my colleagues and friends, Rabia and Dima. I wanted to continue where Rabia left off and to say that under Israeli military law, virtually all Palestinian political parties and movements are considered illegal. And has even despite the so-called, you know, peace agreements and peace processes, there hasn't been change in terms of the change of the classification of Palestinian groups that are political groups active in Israel. So there's always been restriction on political activism, and especially including on very basic rights like freedom of assembly, assembly rights in the West Bank, under Israeli military law is virtually non-existent. It's illegal. You cannot do that without violating military law. In addition to that, Israel resorted to the illegal frame of association, turning and describing and labeling associations that are linked to political parties, not only in the West Bank and Gaza, but we have a history of Israel's doing so even inside Israel. There's a long history that we don't have the time to go into, for example, of banning El Ard movement and associations linked to El Ard as illegal associations, using some of the mandate colonial era laws that allowed the Minister of Interior and subsequently other ministries to put place restrictions and banning altogether these organizations. So there's a long history of banning organizations, whether they are in the political realm or even active in the cultural realm, in the civil society realm more. So the frame of anti-terrorism frame is obviously relatively new, and particularly comes from and escalated after 9/11, as was mentioned earlier. And I think it's a much more comfortable frame for the Israeli government to use in order to crack down on dissent more broadly and to derail the resources, drain and derail the efforts and resources of any Palestinian legitimate human rights organizations, but also more broadly. So when you look back and when this escalation, I mean, it's always been attacks and restrictions on all sorts of restrictions, restrictions of movement, ability to really form any legitimate activism against the Israeli occupation. But the escalation, in my view, really you can trace it back to the Goldstone Report. And the Goldstone Report that is named after the former Justice of South African Constitutional Court, who headed a United Nations fact-finding mission that looked into possible war crimes were committed in the context of the war in Gaza in 2008, 2009, Operation Cast Lead, which resulted in over 1,300 Palestinians killed, 13 Palestinian civilians on the Israeli side, And that was the first time that the UN Human Rights Council mandates a commission that has not only directing, by the way, the mandate to investigate war crimes by Israel, but also by Palestinian armed groups that were participating in that particular military operations, or responding to Israeli military operations. And that was the first time that you have a very serious report, a very serious investigation. It's not a full-fledged investigation because they didn't have even access to the Gaza Strip, and they didn't have ability to get access, and there was no cooperation from the Israeli side. But there was a first serious effort that where Israeli violations of international humanitarian law were documented, including case study, including specific cases where there was a clear violations of the laws of armed conflict, and with clear recommendations and findings that were brought to the Human Rights Council and called for more accountability, and referring the case to international criminal responsibility, particularly as there was more and more cases and more awareness around the International Criminal Court. Of course, by that time, Palestine, the Palestinian Authority, was not part of the ICC. So it was almost very, very difficult to bring, unless there is a referral from the Security Council, to bring a case like this to the ICC. And yet it was clear what the writing was on the wall. That is, it was clear that the Israeli government, for the first time, there was a very credible commission of inquiry. Obviously, Justice Goldstone, after pressure on him personally, retracted some of the findings, but the commission's report stands, and its conclusion, I think, stand without doubt, because the other members did not walk back from the recommendations. But from that point, you see that both the Israeli government as well as NGOs, both Israeli NGOs and international organizations, as well as U.S.-based organizations, launching attacks against not only the Goldstone report as such and undermining its credibility and the importance of its finding, but launching a smear attack against the organizations that were participated and provided testimonies to the Goldstone report. At least two of the organizations that were designated as terrorists participated in that, Damir and Al-Haq. And you would see that NGO Monitor, their first press release on the Goldstone report from September 2009, specifically targeted those NGOs as the political NGOs. So there's a clear identification of these, at least two of the six at that time, that these were targeted, and they're funded by the Swedish government and other European government. From there, there were more laws in Israel, as well as attacks on both Palestinian and Israeli NGOs, limiting, for example, their lobbying on violations of Israel's violation of human rights, with passage of 2016 NGO law that would put restrictions on that. Passage of other restrictions on a movement that was placed on some of the activists. Shahwan Jabarin, for example, was banned from traveling abroad in 2008. And so the two things that happened is that there's a clear indication that as Israel launched other military campaigns on Gaza, again in 2012 and again in 2014, and most recently in May of this year, there was a growing effort and more serious attempts to hold Israel accountable at the international level. We have the UN Human Rights Council establishing a new database on illegal settlements that was a result of many advocacy organizations, including Al-Haq, particularly Al-Haq, because they have a special program on business and human rights. And you have, on the other hand, advocacy in the context of the ICC. And so Israel and its supporters started to use all kinds of ways. And I saw that the security and charity report was posted in the chat in order to undermine those efforts and to smear and to brand both organizations like Al-Haq, Damir, and DCI Palestine and others as linked to terrorism. So to diminish their credibility, to defund them, to accuse them of baseless claims that they were tied to terrorism. At the same time, taking the effort of blocking any attempts to engage in boycotts, particularly with the passage again in 2011 in Israel, the anti-boycott law that placed civil lawsuits liability for people who would call to boycott and that boycott would materialize in some way. And as well as other attempts at, for example, banning Israeli human rights organizations from speaking to students, high school students and schools about human rights violations in the occupied territory. So there was a whole host of ways that the Israeli government, both by legislation, by measures, creating a whole ministry of strategic affairs that was in 2015, that was focused on a coordinating effort to fight what they call delegitimization of Israel, boycotting Israel and attacking and basically holding it accountable before international bodies. So from there, it is clear that we get to the point where the ICC has taken up the investigation and not only in the context of Gaza, but also more broadly in the context of illegal settlements and potentially the crime of apartheid and persecution. So you have international organizations like Human Rights Watch coming up with a serious report documenting the fact that Israel has been engaged in committing the crime the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. And while at the same time the ICC investigation is moving forward, they're clearing hurdles extensive pressure from many countries that are allied of the U.S. or Israel to stop and to block that investigation from moving forward. Three of the six organizations participated actively in providing materials and evidence and information to the chief prosecutor of the ICC. So there is a direct link between their effort, not only in monitoring and documenting human rights locally, something that the Israeli government would not be making that much of an issue with, because as long as you know they're not crossing the line, as we heard from the leaders of the organization last week, once you cross that line, the line is when you place personal liability, criminal liability against Israeli officials, Israeli military leaders for commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity, or making an effective contribution to the effort to boycott Israel and to isolate Israel and sanction Israel, something that DCI Palestine has worked extensively in the last few years by bringing for the first time or helping to bring working with members of Congress and informing them and educating them about the need to have conditionality. So all of these together made it, I think, opportune moment for the Israeli government to say, we could have a case against those six that would send multiple messages, message against holding Israel accountable in international fora, messages to the funders, messages to politicians and policymakers around, particularly in the United States and in Europe, and also messages to Israeli civil society organizations, including international human rights organizations that have joined the effort to hold Israel accountable. Because before the Human Rights Watch report around the issue of apartheid, it was really limited to local, national, Palestinian human rights organizations. Now, it appears that this is becoming a very credible and imminent danger for Israeli officials and for Israel to be, for the first time, facing consequences. So I think that is why we see this case culminating and becoming a point where if it's allowed, if it's this move is allowed to go without consequences, it will be really quite difficult to resist or to push back against anything that Israel would do in the context of the, if it's military occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to dig into a lot of the things that you raised. We're not putting any links in the chat, I don't think, to NGO Monitor. But for folks who hear about this and think this designation came out of nowhere, it's useful to go back to really the Goldstone period on the NGO Monitor website, because what I think is quite instructive is the attack we saw last week is clearly aligned with the attacks we started seeing back in 2006. It's just an escalation of tactics. In 2006, the attack wasn't saying, oh, these are terrorist groups. It was saying they're delegitimizers, or, you know, in subsequent years saying, oh, they BDS, that means they're anti-Semitic. The attacks have been the same over and over and over. It's just the framing. Each time a framing doesn't work, it's like they adopt a new one. And the terrorist framing seems to be the one that they believe will be the knockout punch. Speaking of knockout punch, so Dima, I want to turn to you, and I want you to talk about this from a U.S. and international legal perspective. You're welcome to address anything that's been talked about already, but also specifically, I've had people ask me, explain to me legally how this works, that Israel is alleging terrorist ties, ostensibly, you know, organizations aren't people, they're ostensibly alleging ties or actions that support terror from people within organizations, and yet they are deeming entire organizations to be terrorist organizations. It's, I said to someone, it's like if during the Trump administration, his Justice Department said, oh, we found four people at Planned Parenthood who are somehow involved in the mafia, so we're going to shut down all of Planned Parenthood as an illegal criminal enterprise. How does that hold up under U.S. law, under international law, under any concept of normal, you know, due process, jurisprudence, rule of law?
Thanks a lot again, Laura, and good to be with you all. I think we have to connect what Israel is doing with the broader post, also pre, but especially post 9/11 war on terror, the entire terrorism regime, counterterrorism regime that has been constructed. And, you know, if you look at how what's happening in the U.S., what has happened in the U.S. over the last couple of decades, you know, actually this practice of shutting down entire organizations is very familiar. Just look at the Holy Land Foundation case where, before heads of that organization were criminally prosecuted, the organization itself was designated by the U.S. government. This was a massive humanitarian organization. And along with a couple of others, it was completely shut down. Its finances were shut down, et cetera, after 9/11, of course. And now those who headed those organizations are still behind bars nearly two decades later. So we have to be shocked to hear about the draconian, the politically motivated counterterrorism law that Israel has. And we have to be equally shocked by our own counterterrorism laws and the jurisprudence that has grown around them. In the U.S., it's exceedingly difficult to challenge designations as it is in Israel. These designations often rely on secret evidence. Courts give huge deference to government agencies that make these designations. So there have been very few designations that have been successfully challenged. And again, the implications are huge, not only the freezing of funds, but the opening the door to surveillance, government surveillance, and individual criminal liability. This notion that Israel is unique in using these kinds of strategies, these legal strategies, is just not true. And in fact, it has imported so much of its counterterrorism strategies into the U.S. and globally. We've seen terrorism prosecutions here completely eviscerate due process protections. They've resulted in some of the most Kafkaesque trials. They've relied on the same kind of guilt by multiple degrees of association that Israel relies on. And we see that the evidence for these trials is actually provided by Israel. Israeli intelligence agents are allowed to testify anonymously in U.S. courts, so that defendants can't challenge their testimony. These are undermining fundamental constitutional due process protections, right? Courtrooms have been closed to the public. Evidence is deemed classified so that defendants can't access it. So, you know, in one case that I worked on when I was a law student here in Chicago, the case of Mohamed Salah, you know, it was almost an Israeli style military tribunal in a U.S. court. And that's because the Israeli government was, in fact, constructing the entire case and providing all of the evidence for the case. And the U.S. court, responded to that and to the Israel's pleas to keep the information confidential, et cetera. So, you know, this shouldn't be a surprise. The U.S. has proved to be a critical ally to Israel in this respect as well. And it's in the U.S.'s interest. It's bankrolled and is complicit in Israel's crimes. And so it's gone along with anything that appears to justify them. And the U.S.'s own war on terror. It knows that allowing Israel to be accountable for the actions it's taken to achieve Israel's own settler colonial project would mean that the U.S. has to face accountability for its own original sins of genocide and slavery. So this is all to say that the entire counterterrorism regime in Israel here and just globally really undermines due process because it is reliant on secret evidence. And it's an ultimately a political tool. These are political tools that Israel has helped to develop in the United States as well. That's clear from what Rabia and Jamil have said. This is about these organizations' work to expose Israel's crimes and hold it accountable. And in the same way that people here have been targeted for sending humanitarian aid, for all kinds of advocacy, we're seeing that those who are most effective in exposing and trying to hold Israel accountable are the ones that are being targeted. So the you know, all of the rule of law principles in the world are being buried here and undermined and eviscerated as part of this strategy.
Thanks, Dima. And I think a lot of people probably are unaware of the degree to which post 9/11 anti-terror laws were at least initially used first and foremost against Palestinians in the United States, not against anything to do with Al-Qaeda or the actual, you know, 9/11 activities. They were turned into a weapon against Palestinian American organizations very quickly. And that's a subject for a whole different webinar, but it's certainly related. Rabia, I want to come back to you and sort of picking up on where Dean left off, which is not the most hopeful place in terms of the ability to challenge or litigate the charges in some way. You know, yesterday there were two big articles that came out, one in Haaretz, one that was in 972 in The Intercept. And these two articles shined a light on what is at least some of the so-called evidence that the government of Israel is apparently now sharing in Washington. And we know this because they previously shared this evidence in Europe, and the documents apparently are circulating. The headline of the article in 972 Intercept, I'll read it, it was, "Secret Israeli document offers no proof to justify terror label for Palestinian groups." Can you talk to us about this question of evidence? You know, what is this evidence, as far as you understand it, that Israel is relying on or has relied on? And the legal basis in the anti-terror law, which enables them to use evidence which apparently the Europeans have now repeatedly found to be utterly uncompelling, to categorize things like, according to the article, a Palestinian dance troupe or women's empowerment training as a form of terrorism or support for terrorism.
Yes, thank you, Laura, for this question, because I think it is an opportunity to say something about what this designation is doing already. It is putting these organizations, ourselves included as lawyers or civil society people, in a defense mode, right? It is already forcing, it's the power of this designation, regardless of evidence, is that now we have to start justifying that these organizations are unproved, that these organizations are not terrorist organizations. And this is part of the scheme. This is part of what this designation is intended to achieve. It's a discursive power that shifts the burden on these organizations now to go to international funder and states and etc. and try to say, wait, there is no evidence, in fact. And that's really the situation. No evidence has been provided. We do not know anything about the evidence besides what has been published, both by media, but also in the designation itself. And it is a good opportunity to quote one of the designations. It's a very short paragraph that the designations themselves, which is the order that designates these organizations as terrorists, you know, it's issued by the Israeli Minister of Defense, Benny Gantz. And I'm quoting from the cause of designation, for Al-Haq, which is pretty similar to all other organizations. It's a one paragraph kind of reason, right? And here it goes. Al-Haq organization was established in 1979 and became an arm of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, which has previously been designated as terrorist. Second, the organization is based in Ramallah. The declared Al-Haq activity is in the field of human rights protection. However, in practice, it is engaged on behalf of the Popular Front in promotion of steps against Israel in the international arena, which constitutes part of the terror organization's struggle against Israel. Now, I think this is sufficient to understand that Israel has become so blind to its own use of the terrorism that it's basically saying what we consider is terrorism is promotion of steps against Israel in the international arena. You know, this can include, in fact, legitimate steps, legal steps to enforce international law. We know that Al-Haq is involved in the procedures in the ICC, for example, against the investigation against Israel in the ICC. So this is pretty much the framework or what we know from the designation about why they're considered, according to the declaration itself, as terrorist organizations. Neither the minister Gantz nor any other public official in Israel itself came up officially and shared any shred of information about the evidence that is at core. We just saw in the last week the Intercept article and that reveals this dossier, but the allegations are still very much cryptic. All allegations are based, even according to these revelations, basically, or the Intercept article, you know, we are seeing that these are the evidence, quote unquote, that the designation is based on that was presented to diplomats, to foreign funders or to ministries across the world, is based on four testimonies collected from workers of a different organization, which itself, the Health Work Committees, which itself was designated as unlawful, which is a distinction from terrorist, according to the law. So this is part of, you know, the Health Committees is a seventh organization designated as unlawful organization in January already. And part of its general director, Shada Audi, is placed under administrative detention since. And with no evidence, the idea of administrative detention is, again, that there is no evidence, no concrete evidence that can be sufficient to instate or to issue a criminal process. And we know that every 6 months, these administrative detention can be renewed, etc. So basically, the idea is that according even to the Intercept revelation, these quote-unquote evidence, which is basically the testimonies of two particular workers that used to work prior to that in the health worker committees, which provide help.
Just to be clear, when you say testimonies, you mean confessions under Israel Security Service interrogation.
Exactly. That's what I was heading towards saying, that these testimonies or these confessions are part of an investigation that included torture, according to the lawyers of these people as well. And again, that it's I think that it's not productive to start going through the details of it. I think we should say that we know really nothing and that no evidence has been presented. Even this quote-unquote evidence that Israel has been going around and presenting to foreign governments, you know, including the Dutch and Spanish and other ministers, the Dutch and Belgium, denied that this evidence constitutes any meaningful evidence that pertains to these organizations. So we are just seeing that basically declaring these organizations based on testimonies that are, or based on confessions that are extracted by the way of torture, a practice that has been ostensibly unlawful under Israeli law, but since 1998, when the Supreme Court said, the Israeli Supreme Court said that torture is supposedly unlawful, we know that the practice of torture is very much evident in security investigations. And this has been really came to a climax, I think, with the Tbish case, for those of you lawyers who are following the corpus of Israeli law, which pretty much says, the Supreme Court said, in a case where there were concrete evidence of torture, the Supreme Court dismissed the case and said, opened a wide door for continuing with the practice of torture. Now, this practice of torture is also coupled, comes on top of denying any lawyer meeting with a lawyer or consultation during the investigation. So this is the evidence we're relying on, quote unquote. And I'm satirizing it because we have to satirize it, because we should be aware that we should not be we should not fall into this role of defensive mode to start assuming that there is evidence when no evidence has actually been presented.
Yeah, no, that's a really powerful point. I think going back to the satirizing, one of the things that is striking in reading these articles, it's related to what you read to us about the Al-Haq indictment, which is the definition of terrorist activities, at least by Israel's definition, has now been expanded so broadly that it includes things that are clearly not terrorism by any other definition. At this point, it almost seems like everything is terrorism. And according at least to the article in The Intercept, the confessions that they're relying on are actually being not fully, there's what the confession about the Dub case where they actually cut it off. They cut off the person in mid-sentence. So they basically have someone confessing that these organizations are supporting PFLP activities, but then the journalist got the full transcript of the confession, and then it talks about what those activities are, and they include dance recitals. I mean, it's really, it's quite striking. It satirizes itself, in a sense, if you look at the details.
Yeah, I just want to add, Lara, before that we have seen cases, in fact, that civilian activity has been criminalized under the pretext of anti-terrorism, in particular with Gaza. So there were cases that went again to the Israeli Supreme Court where there was no dispute that the activity, it was even commerce. You know, Palestinian activity, daily life can be criminalized under the pretext of this legislation, under the pretext of this 2016 law that expands the definition of terrorism to include daily activities that are, even according to the Israeli Supreme Court, are legitimate, but can still be considered terrorist. For example, and with this, I'll wrap up on this idea to just understand how even civilian activities in nature, and say that there is no claim that it constitutes any terror. So for example, we know that providing charity or providing any arms of charity / civil service to the community can still be counted as terrorist or charged for terrorist provisions if it is somehow related to these organizations that are declared terrorists. So this is In U.S. terms, it's quote-unquote material support, right? That we know that it's like an overbroad interpretation of this meaning.
Thank you. And Dima, I want to turn to you. And relating to this last question of what is terrorism and evidence, because they're related to what you were talking about before. There seems to almost be almost like tautology here. It's like, you know, they're terrorist organizations because we say their activities are terrorist, and now that we've declared them terrorist, all their activities and support for these activities is by definition support for terrorism. It's, again, that sort of recursive thing. Can you talk about how that figures in with the U.S. side of things? I'm thinking about some of the lawfare cases where, for instance, the Carter Center was charged with material support in a slap suit for providing, and in the lawsuit, I remember you and I both saw it, the word they circled on a picture, they provided fruit, water, and cookies at a public event, and that was a charge of material support for terror. And can you also talk from a U.S. legal standpoint about this whole idea of cases that rely almost entirely on confessions from people who are facing charges themselves, sort of unsubstantiated confessions as being the core of the indictments?
Yeah, I mean, what Rabia was starting to say about U.S. law is really what's at issue here. And under U.S. laws, our provisions for material support for terrorism basically allow the criminalization of speech, of advocacy. So in a Supreme Court decision, Humanitarian Law Project decision several years ago, we saw that, providing human rights training to a designated organization becomes... can be material support for terrorism. And so, you know, this is something that that Israel has trying to push the boundaries on in order to encompass, even speech, even advocacy for Palestinian rights. If you can make whatever tenuous associations with a designated organization, that's all you really need in order to make these claims. So it's a very dangerous it's a dangerous regime that we have here, and it's something that Israel has been exploiting and is clearly trying to exploit in this instance. And when we're talking about evidence, I think there's we've seen efforts to use material support claims in civil cases, right? So an organization, an advocacy organization like the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights was sued based on, 6 degrees of separation with Hamas, right? So you can make that link in any which way, and it sounds absurd, and yet U.S. law allows for this kind of guilt by association. And, the case has been dismissed. It's being appealed, of course. But, in the end, the point is not necessarily what evidence do you have. It's can you make this organization radioactive? Can you suck their resources dry? Can you intimidate other people from engaging on this issue? And that's what we really have to combat here. We have to combat the chilling effect that these kinds of accusations are creating all over the place. And the intention is to isolate. The intention is to distract us from the real issues, distract us from trying to get accountability for Israel's own crimes. In terms of just tortured evidence, just to make the point, again, the extent to which Israel's efforts have been adopted and really used in U.S. courts is terrifying in many ways. There are provisions under U.S. law that to be admissible in court, a confession has to be voluntary. So technically, a tortured confession, like we're talking about in this, the dossier of evidence that Israel has created, should be inadmissible. And yet we've seen in several cases, tortured confessions from provided by Israel admitted in U.S. courts, again, based on secret evidence, based on testimony of disguised Israeli agents in U.S. courts. Rasmi Audi's case was also hinged on a tortured confession, right? When she was charged for an immigration offense. So, you know, the fact is, when it comes to these terrorism issues, the evidence doesn't matter anymore. And these cases are all about guilt by association. They're political, and whatever it takes to secure convictions, to, you know, make examples out of people, is allowed in courts, despite all of our due process protections. So I think that what we have to combat here and in the Palestine context is any credit to Israeli designations, to what the Israeli government says about our civil society groups that are engaged in you know, advocacy, speech, human rights work. And there, that is where we have to focus on continuing on protecting our own people who are engaged in this work, and also tackling this broader problem of the counterterrorism regime, of, you know, the war on terror regime, because that's what has allowed this kind of targeting of civil society to persist.
You have been listening to a discussion of the legal issues that face the attorneys and Palestinian activists who are defending the Palestinian human rights organizations that have recently been designated terrorist organizations by Israel. Attacking these internationally recognized NGOs further illustrates that Israel is losing the public relations battle over the defense of its occupation and colonization of Palestine. Israel has sunk to attacking human rights organizations which serve the Palestinian people. They have offered no credible evidence of terrorist activity, but the consequences of this attack could be severe, not only for the Palestinian people, but also for all of us who dare support the work of these courageous organizations. That is our program today. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.